Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we have a great show dealing with spiritual principles of economy, and I thought that was a pretty good subject for this evening. Now, we've done shows that deal somewhat with economy before. It's going to be somewhat from a different slant. I'm also going to hear some suggestions for people to think about in terms of our present crisis, especially dealing with energy and gas prices and other things. But most importantly, we're going to be talking about what is the spiritual way to run an economy. I mean, you know, we've got a lot of different questions. A lot of people say, well, I think we should be a socialist country because that's more equal. Yeah. And so we'll talk about that and some other things that apply to that. But it isn't just a question of a certain kind of system as much as is how it is executed and who's doing that. So let's get started with these, we'll say, definitions. When I talk about spiritual, I'm talking about the thought of God, the thought of the Creator itself. So something that comes from or is about the spiritual principles is about the Creator's mind and thought. And how is that thought represented either in an economy or not? Principles, I mean, of course, those elements of the Creator's mind that applies to economy and applies in a way that is the fundamental aspects of how an economy does or doesn't work. Okay, that sounds like a pretty good way of defining it, at least as far as I'm concerned. And if you want, you can call in, by the way. I mentioned that occasionally on the show. And you can call in. I'll just give you the U.S. number in case you don't have it. Some people on the phone right now may not have that. It's 877-876-5227. And I mentioned people on the phone in case you don't know it and you're listening on the Internet. The phone number to call in and listen over your phone anywhere. You don't have to be by a computer or whatever, is 712-432-0075. Yeah? Okay. So, what then is the basis? What is the basis for us needing to have an economy? I mean, how come there isn't just enough to go around for everybody and there isn't enough to satisfy the needs and desires of people in terms of things, which usually deals with some kind of form or of energy. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, does that mean food is food like a form? Yeah, food is both a form and it's energy, and without it, we don't run ourselves. But everything else around us is some kind of material thing, and that's a process that's involved in it. Now, if you could say services provided by people, well, services actually come from the efforts or energy that people put out in terms of their mind and their bodies so that others can in some way benefit, and that's certainly part of an economy. So the whole thing together is kind of interestingly intermixed with energy in some fashion or another, not just the energy we think of that comes from a particular kind of fuel, etc. And to answer that first question that I posed, how come we don't just have enough of everything, is because in this realm, the realm that we exist in right now, it's not where we're going to be living after we're dead, but it's where we are right now. In this realm, there is a need for the seventh part of God's mind and energy. There's really three parts of God's mind, but the third part is divided up. And in that third part that's divided up, it goes all the way to the seventh part of God. And the seventh part of God is about economy. So in other words, when we talk about what is God doing, it's growing itself. And the hardest way for God to grow itself is in terms of economy. Now you might say, well, why? How come God has a problem with economy? Well, it has to do with the idea of this. God creates, this is my theory, a lot of people agree with it, and many other sources do as well, God created life so that life could be free and at the same time grow itself either more into or away from, if it chooses to, God. So God has this system going. And the system allows us, life, being part of life, to either choose a path that applies God's principles of economy, which would cause us to grow closer to God, because then it would be spiritual, or to grow away from God and away from the principles and to see where that leads us to, and others that do the same, or others that choose to. So here is a system that is giving us opportunity for growth in whatever direction you choose to go, and freedom to go in a direction other than God's. But woe to those who choose that. Nonetheless, that is the bottom line of God's system, is that it's going to be an open-ended system, not prescribed. And you could say, well, but it sounds like the cards are kind of fixed here, or the dice are fixed, or something's going on, because you got God's way, and then you got the other way. And the other way that you're saying isn't going to probably turn out very good. Well, that's true. But that's only to be of assistance, because if God's wrong, which it's a little hard to understand that concept, but if God's wrong, then fine, we can go ahead and do whatever we choose to do and prove that we can be better than God. I don't think we're going to make that. And then the other possibility is, if God's way, the spiritual way of having an economy, is correct, well, then we all can find that out through the errors of not being completely spiritual in the way that we create our own economy about ourselves and about others that we are associated with, and in a national sense and also in a world sense. So the interesting thing about this is that it's just the broadest approach you could have if you were a creator of the universe, to making the toughest thing that can be done for life is to find a system of economy that meets the principles of God and provides at the same time sufficiently for those who follow those principles for as long as they choose to follow them. This is the kind of guidelines that I'm suggesting here. Now, this is a little different than most people who are economists or people who talk about economy tend to bring it up. They don't usually address it from that side, if they even think of it from that side. But I'm thinking about it that way. And the reason I am is I think that if we don't look at the biggest picture possible and we start talking about any other principles of economy, there is no yardstick to understanding where that actually ends up. Oh, there's lots of people that have argued this form of system works better than that form, and on, but the real bottom line is, does it meet the God test? If it doesn't meet the God test, we're probably not going to fare too well. So that's the point I'm making this evening. Again, these are assumptions to some extent, but they're worthwhile to test out. Okay, so this is where we begin. Now you might say, well, how come God didn't just make it a lot easier? Why not just make this lowest realm of time and space and energy, which is where we are right now, why not just make that a little easier so everybody can, you know, get on with things and not have such a hard time? Well, God doesn't want us to suffer. God wants us to grow. There's a big difference. And the growth comes from the challenges of a universe that is set up to maximally produce growth at the least amount of suffering necessary on the part of those that choose to be selfish or away from God's thought. So, in reality, the system is set up to minimize suffering, if anything. But unfortunately, people could also be excessively selfish, which will only increase suffering. And it isn't meant as punishment. It's meant as an encouragement to grow. So that's the basic concept, the encouragement to grow. Now, for those of you who are evolutionists and say, yeah, well, what about survival of the fittest? Yeah, okay, God made that too, right? Yeah, God made what we call survival of the fittest, which is in actuality a less than conscious position, and certainly a non-God conscious position for life to take. That's for things that are alive, but aren't conscious enough to be aware of their own creator. So for them, specifically, evolution works fine. For humans who have the ability to sense their own creator and sense ways that they can be like their creator, that's a different story, because we have the ability to discern between those things that are like God's mind and those things that are not. The lower forms of life below us, below humans, don't have that. So God says, well, I'll give their group soul, which has a limited ability to make changes on a mass level, but it can't make individual changes for the most part, on any individual members of its group, it gives them the ability to make broad stroke changes over time, which we think, in terms of our observation, is being evolutionary. Yet, at the same time, they have to deal with tremendous forces, which includes, unfortunately, survival of the fittest. Animals feeding on each other, some of them, and animals at the mercy of nature in general. So humans are not mostly at the mercy of nature. We are a small fraction of the time. And when we are, we can improve our understanding of our Creator and work with nature to produce better results. We can choose to do that. Or we can choose to do the opposite, which usually produces some seriously bad results. Now you can say, well, what about the poor Japanese? I mean, you know, a month ago they had a terrible earthquake. Yesterday they had another aftershock, which was not that small. It was a pretty serious earthquake, and still hundreds of people died from that. So we have to be concerned, you know, like, what does that mean? Well, what it means is this. Sure, the folks in Japan are kind of, and I'm not going to say they chose to live in Japan, that's their problem. No. They're kind of stuck to some extent with the land that they presently live on. I mean, you know, they tried the other way, go conquer the world and then live wherever you want, but that didn't work out for them so well in World War II. At any rate, they have choices that they can make in their economy, as an example. Do they spend X zillions of dollars building a nuclear power plant that can survive an 8.2 quake, or maybe 50% or 75% more than that for the same kind of facility that can survive a 9.5 quake? They made that choice. That's a choice based upon economic issues, but did they follow the principles of God? My argument would be probably not, or they wouldn't have lost 15,000 or more people in the initial incident, probably more like 20 or 25. Nobody's counting yet. And if it isn't more than that. And then who knows how many people will now be stricken with various cancers and other deprivations and terrible things that are still ongoing. But you see what I'm trying to get at here. And this is not in any way to disparage the Japanese folk. Everybody, all nations, all peoples make selfish mistakes because they don't follow the principles of God. And what are one of those principles? Well, one of the principles is that economy needs to be balanced in terms of the benefits versus the costs to all people, excuse me, involved in the economy, not just those that are expending, like a power company or something in a government, the money to do something. And that's the problem. So we have some really basic issues here. So, you know, a lot of people say, well, isn't capitalism great? Well, capitalism is wonderful, provided that it includes some of these principles that I'm going to be talking about tonight. Now, does that mean that communism does that? No, not at all. It doesn't do any better. It does worse than what I just suggested. But there's still something lacking in both, and I want to talk about that. So I'm suggesting that one of the primary basic principles of God's economy is that you have to observe and consider all people's cost in anything that is done, not just the cost of the people who, quote-unquote, are the investors, okay? The investors are people who invest money, but a whole society invests in some kinds of things like power plants, especially nuclear power plants, and there are greater concerns. So whoever is going to be affected in the economy by some aspect of whatever is being transacted in that economy, they have to be considered. And if that were true, and I want to give you uses as an example, because these are big concepts tonight, and I want to use this as an example to try to get us to the point where we understand this concept. Let's say we could go back 20 years or whatever, and let's say some of these power plants, where they were being designed and, you know, et cetera, you put before the Japanese people the odds of there being a 9.0 earthquake, which would exceed the limits of the plant that is being proposed at 8.2 Richters, and the result would be the following, and you explain it. You say, well, this is what's going to happen. The plant's going to pretty much melt down. There's going to be terrible people, and a lot of people are going to die, and there's a tsunami that's going to come on. It's going to kill people that live around the plant and flood everything, and the water's going to get contaminated a million times worse, and, you know, no, no, no. And you tell them all this. And I mean, literally, it would have to be a sort of a participation by the people who are being affected. In this case, it's the whole country, right? Because this is a countrywide. It's actually beyond the country. It starts affecting the whole world. But it's a countrywide thing. Okay, so then you tell everybody. And you say about once every 300 years, and they know this. They knew this. They didn't know it, but they suspected it was true 20 years ago. They knew it. They certainly knew it about 5 to 10 years ago, that about every 300 years, one of these earthquakes happens, either on our coast off of the northwest, Pacific Northwest, or on the other side in Japan. Literally, they sort of play ping pong with each other. And so every 300 years, we can expect this to happen, first them and then us, or vice versa. And it happens within about 25, 50 years of each other. Guess what's happening in the U.S. next? Okay, but that's another story, right? We're talking about Japan right now. Okay. So you just tell everybody it's going to happen every 300 years, and it has been 300 when he started developing the plants, about 291 years or 92 years since the last one. Now, do you want to do, and the last one was a 9.0. We know that. It was 9.0. Do you want to go ahead and build the plant to about 9.5? We have no record of 9.5. Or do you want to build it to an 8.2? We'll save 50 to 75% of the cost of the plant if we go just to an 8.2, which would you prefer? Unless you're one of the direct investors in the plant, I think the cost would go up. But you have to let everybody know that their electric rates are going to go up because you're building it more, so electricity is going to cost more, 50 to 75% more, maybe not that much because there's transmission costs and other things, maybe 40% more. But then when one of these 9.0 earthquakes hits, guess what? We'll be safe, and everybody will be happy. I hope this is making some sense to all you folks out there, because I've never talked about it in these terms before, and this is like a whole other way of understanding economy, because we have to look at who's being affected and what say-so we're giving them in the process. Because if we don't give them a say-so, we become karmically responsible. So the government and the people involved with the utility constructors, everybody, they all become, to some degree, responsible for what happened. That's a big responsibility, believe me. You don't want to have it on your hands. And, of course, then there's suffering. And the suffering extends not just to people who suffer and die from the terrible incidents, but also all the people later on who will pay dearly for having not built these plants correctly and a lot of other issues. Sure, there'll be lawsuits. I guess that's one way you could say, well, that's part of the karma. And yeah, I guess so. But other things will happen that are not directly by humans. Because that's the way the world, that's the way the universe is set up. All right, so now I think this puts a whole different slant on what we're talking about when we say spiritual principles of economy, not just principles of economy. And it means something different in terms of these theories that so often are kicked around and the ideologies of economy, because everything is in a somewhat different light, because a criteria has been imposed by our Creator that makes us much more responsible for the things that we do in our economy and others in theirs and on a worldwide basis as well. Now, I'm not a world kind of global person thinking that the whole world should be functioning under one form of government. Quite the opposite. I think that's dangerous right now, because the only government that even comes close to being, at least in principle, by God's principles, and it's not principles of government, but spiritual principles of government, but we've had a show about that, is the United States, and that's only in its created form, not in how it is executed. And so we're far away from that. We don't want to have a system where everybody's the same, because we will fall to the common level, the combined common level, which would be terrible, because we have terrible countries in some quarters that are doing horrible things to the people, and some of that would then become a standard operating procedure. Okay, so we've got this system then based upon the first principle. First principle is that you have to apply this to all the people that it's going to have significant effect upon. They have to have some reasonable way of having input if it's going to significantly affect them. Now, that doesn't mean that if you want to sell gidgets and you open a gidget factory that you have to go out to the public to see who does or doesn't like gidgets. That's not what I'm talking about at all. I'm saying if it is going to have a significant impact on them, if the gidgets you sell are going to shorten life expectancy of people by 10 years, that would be a serious issue that you'd want to discuss with people. Now, you can say, well, don't we have the FDA and the Consumer Product Safety Commission and all those other places in the United States are supposed to do something about it? Yeah, but their problem is that they don't function with the spiritual principles of God. They function with the principles as usually are created by the pharmaceutical companies or sometimes the manufacturers of certain products, the food industry, the beef industry, I don't know. So you get all this stuff coming in from political issues and not from the people that are being affected in general, just the ones that have their money invested or some other significant investment. Everything's too much based upon money. Yeah, that's a big factor. Another principle of God. Let's talk about money. Money is compressed time and energy. And God's principle of it is that it needs to be used for the benefit of others more than for the benefit of ourselves. I'm going to say that again. Money, which is compressed time and energy, meaning that you don't need it at the moment. You don't have to use it to stay alive. It's compressed. It's saved. You can put it in the bank, whatever. The money that you have has to be used in a greater amount and source for others than for yourself, and the others that you use it for need to be doing the same. This is God principle. Number two. Okay, principle number two. And you're probably scratching your head and saying, well, I give my 10% at church, and this 10% won't cut it. Because number one, the church may not be giving it or using it for people who are going to go do the same for others. They're probably just meeting certain basic needs for people, regardless of whether those people are going to become more giving in the process. They may become more selfish, but they don't care. Well, they may care, but they don't do something about it. And the other thing to remember here is that 10% is not more than half. More than half needs to go for the betterment of others doing the same. Wow, how do you manage to do that and still be in business or whatever? Well, the answer is this, that you design and create businesses and function in those businesses in ways that helps other people to do the same and to be a model for being that kind of business, including the way you treat your employees, the way that you make your products, the way you stand behind them, how you represent them, and what kind of things you create, services or products, that actually benefit others in ways that help them to continue to do the same for other people. Ah, that's what I'm talking about, if you're talking about businesses. Now, if we're talking about people who just, well, say, are working for a business, it doesn't change any of the principles I'm saying. You then, if you're working for a company, want to only work for companies that are doing this. Well, times are tough. I can't get a job. I'll take a job with anybody. Well, I understand that. That's one of the problems of our system in economy, is that sometimes there aren't enough things for people to do working for others, so that sometimes those people have to start becoming more resourceful to work for themselves. Again, it's the push towards being more creative and being more of a, we'll say, addition to the system than someone who's just riding along. So if there aren't enough jobs, then some people, the more creative ones, have to make them for themselves and for others. You see how that works. Some people aren't so creative, so they work for a company, hopefully, that follows the spiritual principles that I'm discussing. And then, if they can't work for that company, they try to work for the ones that can find the best, most spiritual company they can work for. But if they can't find any, then they're in a quandary. And then they probably need to really look into being more resourceful on their own. Tough times. This is tough. These things that I'm suggesting are not easy to follow. But they, over the long run, alleviate suffering rather than create it. It sounds hard to believe right now, doesn't it? By the end of the show, I think you'll see that they do. But for the these spiritual principles I'm suggesting, then everyone is really looking out for everyone else, but not on a personal level, on a soul level. Kind of a different kind of looking at the system. If you're following, I hope you are. Okay, so another principle. That's a good one. I like that one. I hope you like that principle too. Another principle that the Creator has is that if a person gains tremendous amounts, very large amounts, even if they're giving away half or more of their money to others in some way, if they have a tremendous amount, then they have to become tremendously more creative. And this is the problem that the concept of philanthropy does not address. In other words, you can't just give your money away. Some people do that because they underneath it all, they have this conscience about God's thought. And they think, well, I'm not supposed to have all this money. But giving it away to others isn't the answer. Giving it in ways of being more creative so others can be more creative is the answer. Yes, you're supposed to give some of it, not have, you know, you could give away half your money. But the other half, you have to create enough with that part so that more and more businesses and more types of economy are created. Some of these may be service. Some of these may be something dealing interactively with the governments and business and industry together. It could be a lot of different things. It can be expressions in art. It depends on the nature of the person. But the point is that having too much money without using it shows a lack of creativity. And that usually leads to suffering, even if you give the money away beyond the half or so that you already did. It's you gave it away either in services, products, or helping others just to get into business, or something you did. Some of the ways that people who have been faced with this have worked is they keep lessening the amount of profit they make. That's one possibility. But there are limits to that. If you lessen it too far, you break God's principle of just giving people stuff without looking at what they are doing to create with it. So if you give people cars and houses for almost nothing, it's not a solution. Even though you may produce them at a very cheap price, it's not a solution to the issues that I'm discussing. You're still expected to be much more creative and not keep just giving the money away. That's not the answer. All right. Hopefully this all makes sense. These are kind of big concepts, like I said. I haven't discussed them before, so some of you are kind of scratching your heads. I don't know if I can keep up with this. But the thing is that you can go back. I'll stop right now trying to define more and more stuff. But you could go back and listen to the show and try to get down what it is that I'm saying here so that you can kind of see how it all fits together. I could give you a couple more principles, but I think that I'm getting over the top here and how much to say about this. There's lesser principles that apply to, and maybe they'll come up later in the show. But these are the biggies, the ones that I just talked about. And they're good ones. They're real good ones if you can follow them. That's excellent. Okay, so now let's get to how does this all play out. If we've got, let's say that we're trying to make the United States economy become more spiritually principled, and what are the things that you can do? Let's say we can now start waving a magic wand and making things happen. Okay. So what is wrong in our economy? Well, a whole bunch of things. If you listen to what I just said in the first 30 minutes of the show, a whole bunch of things are wrong in our economy. And they are wrong because they are based upon principles of darkness rather than light. Spirit is light in form. And these are darkness in form that we're working on. Yes, we have a very enlightened constitution. Some of our laws, even anti-monopoly laws, are pretty enlightened. But the basis of how we go about doing economy is not very well enlightened. Let's take some examples and see if we can work on them. I'm going to take right off the bat this business, so I don't run out of time later, this business about gasoline, and energy in general, and what's wrong with the principles that we're applying. Well, the first thing is we have factions fighting about this. We have a president who is against almost everything except alternative energy. He claims he's in favor of some nuclear energy, but he has denied all nuclear projects in the Bald Mike Mountain thing where they were supposed to take the waste as big clothes. I mean, there's no way to create any more significant, you know, forms of nuclear energy in this country because it's been stopped, basically. Okay, so that's pretty much off the table, and that doesn't leave much. I talked about wave energy, harnessing the sea's wave energy, which is really solar energy in disguise, solar becoming wind and then becoming waves. But that's pretty far off. We could do it in probably less time than direct solar energy can be developed as a source of substantial power. And we could use that as an alternative source in terms of in comparison to ethanol, which is useless in a negative return, and it's eating up our food supply. But it's still not going to be a complete answer right away. It's probably 5 to 10 years off before we would really get one of these plants built, and we need several of them to produce a lot of power. Although I did talk about that a few years ago, and I thought it's an excellent idea. I don't know why we're not pursuing it. And there's one or two in existence. They're in the Middle East, of course. So we need to be considering that as a source of power. Wind has some negatives. You know, they're sometimes noisy. They kill a lot of birds. They disturb even the rotation of the Earth if you get a lot of them going. And they're not what you would call per dollar of input, except in certain selected areas, very cost-effective right now. So they're not going to be able to replace in cost the more traditional forms of energy, whereas the wave energy, by the way, might. So we're in a close call with that one. So that's not a good alternative either. So, but certainly we could do it in certain locations. It might be of some value. And we're not going to get over 18% of our energy with wind. That's about the limit we could do in the United States. And so that's not going to work too well either. And then we look at other alternatives. Well, geothermal. Geothermal is pretty good, except only some areas are really good for it and others are only so-so. The so-so areas cost so much to get the energy out of the ground that the payback is like 100 years or something. It doesn't really pay back. And even in the better areas, the payback is like 10 to 15 years. Still not great, but better. So if you're in a geothermal area that has a lot of underground heat fairly close to the ground, to the surface of the ground, then that's not too bad. If you have to go down hundreds of feet and start pumping and all this other stuff, by the time you're done, you've got like a $1 million facility to run like a half a dozen houses. It doesn't quite pencil out. So that's the problem with the geothermal stuff. You know? And I mean, we're still working on it. Hey, it could get there. You just don't know. I like conservation, though. Conservation is our biggest, safest bet, because conserving energy is far more effective than making alternative energy at the present time. Now, conserving energy, we can conserve about 50 to 60% of all the energy that we use at the present time in the United States. That includes the energy we use for cars and trucks. I know a lot of people say, well, that's not possible because cars and trucks are using all these billions of gallons of oil and all this other stuff. Yeah, I know, except that we can right now make cars and trucks about 50% more efficient by doing two things, making them much lighter in terms of weight, especially cars, and reducing the amount of fuel that they use by using technologies that are already here that companies just haven't decided to put them into the production yet. The last year or two, there's been more of that, but not enough. So we can make cars twice as efficient, and so far we'd save half the energy, just like that. Boom. That's how we can save it. Conservation also can come from the way people drive to some extent, yes, and making them educated a little better, and there's certain things you can do. Now, I've gone over what we can do with cars and trucks, and it's easy to see how you can actually save half of the energy. Now, what would happen if we saved half of our energy? Let's say you just take the number, whatever it is, in terms of joules, kilowatt hours, whatever measurement you want to use, and cut it in half. Well, if you cut it in half, the amount, and you didn't do anything else, the amount of imported oil that we would be buying would be about 15 to 20% of what we're presently buying. Oh, that would be good. That's a real good idea. Okay, what else? The amount of pollution that people either believe or don't believe is going to be pumped into the atmosphere is going to be cut in half, whatever that amount is. Okay? And as soon as you start cutting that down, you have to do less things to cars, automobiles, and other forms of pollution to keep things at least at the status quo. And those things that they've been doing mostly cost us fuel. So we, again, reduce even fuel consumption that way just by reducing use. Buildings and dwellings in general would be much more comfortable, much more, much easier to live in. Things like air conditioners and heaters would last much longer because they weren't going to be used only half the time. And people's bills for costs for those kinds of things would be cut in half. That amount of money put back into people's pockets is maybe 15% to 20% of their total spendable income, depending on who they are and how they're living. That's a lot of money. If you just gave that much money to people, that would really help the economy, right, in terms of just pure dollars and cents. So people are going to benefit from all these things. And how is it then that it falls now in the spiritual side of things? Well, one of the good things about energy or bad things is that it tends to affect everybody. So when gas goes up, almost everybody pays more. And when it goes down, everybody is saving some. So this has a general benefit to all people. It would benefit even more people if we allow people to start retrofitting various types of inventions and devices onto automobiles. I'm working with some people that have some ideas about that. But the point is that you can do a number of things to the existing automobiles, not just the ones that they're selling. And that would make a significant difference. I've talked about some of these things in the past, and there's even more. But these things are going to be taken on by the people who want to conserve energy the most for either or both, either the benefit of everyone else in terms of less use of energy and better environment, or because they just want to save money, or both, probably both. So this is a good thing because those people actually are benefiting also because they are looking ahead to also being of some service to other people besides just themselves. So there's a lot of things that you could say are good about this kind of way of looking at things. Now, what about the concept of, you know, drilling for oil? And what is the truth about that whole situation? Well, we have somewhere between 2 and 3% of the known reserves in the world. But here's the point. The real reserves of the United States in terms of oil and gas equals over half of the world. I know that sounds hard to believe, but the real reserves are not the proven reserves because the government won't let anybody drill in the areas where gas and oil are highly suspected to be found in large quantities. And you might say, why in the heck are they doing that? Totally political. Completely political. It's a power thing. It has to do with controlling the economy. Some politicians don't want the economy to prosper in some circumstances. So it's a strange thing. It's a very strange thing. I'm not talking about just oil now. I'm talking about oil and gas. So that's a huge, huge amount. And then we have, like, in proven reserves, we have about 60-65% of all the coal. Now you start saying, we have all that coal, we have all the oil, that much oil and gas. Now in the oil, I'm including what some people call the kind of oil that you have to separate, shale oil, from sand. They're doing it in Canada very successfully. So we could do it here. Again, the government's not permitting that. So I'm including things that many people don't even know about. Okay, so, and offshore, where the biggest areas of oil exist, the United States is ignoring, in our own coastline. Now, granted, people say, well, look what happened in the Gulf last year. Yeah, look what happened. Well, we managed to pull that one out, and it was poorly managed, very poorly managed. We should have had a flotilla of every ship on the planet coming here that wanted to help out. There were dozens of countries that offered, and we didn't accept their help. A couple we accepted months and months after the incident. So, I mean, there's something wrong with that, too. That's a serious political manipulation problem. Okay, so these things are definitely serious issues. Anyway, I just recognized I'm a couple minutes over here, so I need to take a little break here, and when we come back, I'll continue with some of these ideas. And we should be doing it in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds, give or take, from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. I was really getting long-winded there. I could have kept going without a break in anything. Anyway, let's get back to our subject tonight, spiritual principles of economy. And last I was talking about some of the amount of oil and gas, including shale oil and gas in areas that have not yet even been explored but have extremely high potential of having large amounts of gas. Okay, so we have a huge amount, about 50%, if you combine the two together, of the world's oil and gas. I know it's 3%, you keep hearing that, 2%, we keep hearing that. It's not. Those are the proven oil reserves, and that's coming from the areas we've already tapped out. So, obviously, if you've already tapped something out, you're not going to have much left, right? Okay. But that's how the crazy system, the political system, is presently working to redefine these crazy these things. So what should we do? Well, my suggestion is the following. We make a plan to get off of oil and gas because, in reality, it's not renewable. And eventually, no matter how much you have, you're going to run out. And no matter how much you believe it does or doesn't hurt the environment to put it into the atmosphere and into the oceans, et cetera, then you still have to have some respect for people who do believe that. And if they're right, we should be doing what we can to stop it. And if other people are thinking otherwise, then fine, it won't change anything with the plan I suggest. This is what I think is a spiritual way of dealing with that. And we'll go to other areas and other parts of the economy and how things are working. But since gas prices are a big time issue right now, first of all, I suggest a conservation. That would cut down half of our usage. Strangely, if you cut down half of our usage, it removes about 35% of the price of fuel. Okay. Whoa. And one part of the reason you save so much is because you can have less blends of gasoline. You could have, because remember, we're cutting a lot of pollution. You don't have to worry as much about pollution. And so you could do a lot of things that will get you by, and you could give you a tremendous boost to the economy. So just immediately, because you're using so much less, over a third of the cost of gasoline goes away right off the bat. So let's say by summer, we're at $4.50 a gallon. Now we're back down to $3. And at $3 a gallon, people are using half as much. You understand what I'm saying? So that's a good deal. Now, the next thing I suggest is T. Boone Pickens' idea, and I like it, of using natural gas for, like, trucks, et cetera, especially ones that are being sold new. Well, that makes a lot of sense because we have a huge amount that we can use for that purpose and for some others, including the manufacturing of electricity. Those are good things. Excellent. Not a bad thing at all. Okay. Then, fine. We'll have that come into play, too. And then what about, so now we're talking about a tremendous amount of gas and oil production increase is what I'm suggesting. To the max, just allow people to produce as much as they possibly can. It'll drive down world of oil prices to some extent, not as much as you would think, maybe 10 or 15, 20%. But here in the United States, we'll save a lot more. And it does something else, which is really interesting. It provides a tax base for what I'm going to suggest next. And a tax base is the following, that for every, say, dollar somebody saves in fuel, they pay a 25 cents tax for renewable energies and the future development of nuclear and coal plants that have less pollution issues, okay? And the problem is, so it's a subsidy, in effect, for some coal plants, the dirtiest first, and then some new ones to get online. And it's a subsidy for them to produce cleaner energy at a lower price. And at the same time, use the remaining money to develop alternative energy. This is a huge amount of money because we spend so much on fuel. It literally is hundreds of billions of dollars being made available to alternative energy and to make our coal plants much cleaner than they are today. I'm not talking about, just like keeping things as they are. I'm talking about cleaning things up without raising the price of energy. And the reason you need to do this is you have to think about it as God thinks about it, okay? As I think God thinks about it. And that's this. We have a national interest. Therefore, if someone has a coal-fired plant by their house and they're paying for electricity, if we force that plant to clean itself up by 70%, get rid of 70% of the carbon dioxide and the coal-emitted sulfurs and the coal-emitted dusts and the fumes and all this other stuff, it is a good thing. But their electricity in that area would be hurt. And we look at it from a whole national scale, and we say, well, this is something that's really not good because we're hurting part of the population. It's not a fair thing to do. So what we'll do is we'll balance this thing out by these taxes over all the people on gas and oil. But those prices are going to go down anyway. So we're not going to suffer from this at all. As a matter of fact, everyone's going to benefit from it. But there's still some available resources to be used to build generation from waves and some wind and solar, as well as to clean up the coal, and to produce a much nicer, we'll call it, system as far as the energy production goes in our country. And we make this like a 20 to 25-year plan in which the object is to use any and all of the gas, oil, coal we have. We have a lot more coal than either of the other two, but for that period of time, by the time we're done, we might be running out of some oil, might be running out of some gas. But at that point, we'll have more than enough coal. And if we've already produced coal-fired plants that are now up to 90 or 95% efficient without having to put out carbon dioxide, so we've come up with new technologies, what I'm saying, in that period of time, then it's not an issue. We also have built much safer than the Japanese built, nuclear power plants. I think nuclear is fine, but you've got to then do it right. I mean, you don't build a nuclear power plant that can withstand an 8.2 quake in an area that you know you're going to have a 9.0 in. I don't care how much more it costs. Or you just don't build a plant in the first place because it doesn't make any sense, especially when you know approximately when it's coming. So it's not a good idea. And we also go, and with the plants, the nuclear plants that we already have, we make an assessment of which ones may be hit by either an earthquake or some other disaster and do something about that ahead of time instead of waiting. But we use the revenues from our existing resources because we're broke. And if we don't do it this way, we'll never do it. And never doing it is a very bad thing. So you use what you got while you have it, and you use it to benefit everyone, and you use it to benefit the world and the planet, and you make capitalism as part of the system because that's the system that really helps people to be creative and gives them the opportunity to be a co-creator with their creator. Every other system blocks it in some way. But you also control it to some extent by taxing in certain ways and by it isn't redistributing wealth, it's evening out cost. There's a big difference. We're not taking wealth from the wealthy and giving it to the poor. We are taking the cost and making it fair to everybody. So people in one area aren't going to suffer immensely while others in some way get some great boon. That's the point. And that's a big difference between redistribution of wealth, which is so popular in socialism, and communism. Okay, so this system that I'm suggesting now hopefully is starting to make some sense to everybody. I hope so, because it actually produces benefits to everybody. It's not like some kind of real terrible thing that's going to make everybody suffer or is going to take from the rich and give to the poor, like some Robin Hood of government. No, it's a system in which it's still very capitalistic, more than it is today, by the way. Yet it does involve, strangely, taxation. But taxation that gives everybody a fair chance and allows the technology of our society to grow, because technology is going to decline in the next 12, 13 years. That's going to happen, I'm telling you. And so the only way we're going to keep it growing is to use a system that's more intelligent than the present principles of economy. Now, why is technology going to decline? That's another show, I know, but it has to do with the third rate going on in focus. And so we've got some issues here. And we better start paying attention to these issues in terms of our principles and economy. Now you could say, well, okay, let's say we do the things that you suggest. Someone can magically make this happen because right now the president's 100% against it and most of his party is. So what are we going to do about that? As a matter of fact, I'm not saying the Republicans are necessarily in favor of this either. The way to deal with this is that the people out there, us, we need to be really pushing on this. Now, I know there's people out there who have said things like this before, a little bits and pieces, but we need like a bigger kind of group that is representative of a kind of different thought process. One is more spiritual behind it rather than just make things so people make more profit or whatever. Now, this system that I'm suggesting would make oil companies and gas companies, et cetera, extremely wealthy because they would be pumping more, they'd be selling more. But remember this, that it isn't the profits that are the problem. It's what they do with them. So, you know, part of this taxation issue is kind of like forcing them to do so, but I would also put it in as an option that if they voluntarily invest in new technologies, they don't have to suffer the tax. How about that? So it's one way or another. You either voluntarily go more into this or you pay more of a tax on it. Now, some of these companies are investing in some of these technologies, but, you know, a lot of it is pretty much the topping on the cake, and it's not meant in the slightest way to really make a difference. It's only meant to make themselves look good. Well, we've invested in solar panels. We're making 500 a day. It's huge, you know. It's not how many you produce. It's coming up with a solar panel that is effective and cost-effective and works. And that's the real problem. So R&D is a major part of it. And that's only minimally done by actual oil companies. I know I've seen the ads. We've all seen them. But believe me, by now, if they were putting all that money in that could have been put into developing solar panels that they're five times more efficient, that also work off of heat and solar or light photons, they'd be much more effective than where they are today. It's 150 watts that falls on the average square foot of planet Earth every second, or every, you know, 150 watts per second or 150 watts per hour, depending on how you want to look at it. But 150 watts. And a really good solar collector collects less than 20. Okay? And so, and there's ways to, that's even the minimal aspect of the solar radiation, not the heat. Not the heat itself. There's other aspects to it. Okay. So, I'll give you a little break right now, and then we'll kind of come back and talk about other elements of economy that need to be addressed tonight, in my opinion. I'm going to talk about how we have a healthcare system that kind of makes sense to some people and some other things that I think are important if it's going to be a spiritual supported principle in terms of the way the economy works. Let's take a break for a minute here and let me talk to you. If you're going to be in the Phoenix area on April 23rd, last week I said the 30th because I was confused, but people were also giving me wrong information. April 23rd, I'm going to be doing a workshop over at where am I going to do it? I gotta get the name of the place right here. Anyway, I'm going to be doing a workshop, and I'll tell you what the workshop's on, and then I'll get the name of the place. It should be here right in front of me, but for some reason it isn't around. Somebody took my sheet away. All right. And this workshop is going to be on how to get and stay healthy, and it's going to be talking about alternative methods that we can use to do that. And I got all kinds of papers on my desk, and I can't find the one I'm looking for. And hopefully you can come. It's going to be at 1:30 in the afternoon. That's on Saturday. And if you want to join up, let's see, it's going to be over at Healthy something. What I said last week. I'll get it later in the show. If not, I'll have to mention it next week. But if you're in the Phoenix area, 1:30 next Saturday, not next Saturday, the Saturday of the 23rd, plan on coming because it's going to be a great workshop. It'll be like an hour and a half or something like that. And it's free. There's no charge for it, none whatsoever. Somewhat limited capacity. We might be able to go to a bigger place, but somewhat limited. I know it's under 100. I'm not exactly sure the number of people that can sit in this room. And we're going to be doing it in a way. way in which people can address issues, not just, it's not just me talking. So if you've got something you want to talk about, I'll be addressing issues that people might have in terms of what kinds of alternative methods of treatment they can be looking into and ways to stay healthy naturally, which is the name of the workshop, staying healthy naturally. And so this is going to be a great opportunity for people to come by, say hello, whatever. That's if you're going to be in the Phoenix area. I know the place is going to, the address is going to be on 7th Street and Bethany. Last week I said 7th Avenue. And so it's 7th Street and Bethany. I think it's called the Healthy something or other vitamin store. And I'll get the whole name. And I'll be there talking because there's been a lot of people interested in some of the products that I've helped to formulate for people, et cetera. And it's been overwhelming to some extent. I was on a show last week, another radio show, and a lot of people were interested in what I said about this. So I think you could come by and find out a lot of information. I also want to mention about Fai Chi Jizik. If you are still having some kinds of pains or whatever, try Fai Chi Jizik. And we're going to be coming out in another month or so with a kind of extra strength formula. And you might want to find out a little bit more about that. In the meantime, the formula we have is great. You can try it out if you want to. Get it, get buygizik.com. You can go to the website. The phone number is 602-431-5762. Give us a call. Okay, let me get back to what we're talking about tonight. I wonder what happened to all my sheets. Anyway, all right. Live radio, it's fun. All right. Let's talk about health. Healthcare is a concern people have because we want to be a compassionate society and we don't want to see people ill. And we think that by having low-cost healthcare, people will stay healthier. Well, that's kind of not true, but I'm going to bring up some quandaries if we talk about spiritual principles as they apply to healthcare. When someone is not paying for their health care to a substantial amount, and I'm not talking about insurance now, because insurance can have the same problems I'm going to bring up right now, they may not be as concerned about taking care of their health. So the investment of a person in wanting to be healthy and also not wanting to have to pay out of their own pockets a significant amount of money is an encouragement for them to do things that will help them to stay healthy. One of the things our society, especially in the United States, doesn't do properly is we are so concerned about whether people are getting access to health care, which means paying very little for health care, when we're not concerned about trying to help them stay well. And I know, the president's health care plan has a lot of stuff to help people get well. No, it doesn't. First of all, staying well involves very little that is in the traditional allopathic medical model. It's almost totally based on a disease process issue. And it tells us very little about what we can do to stay well. And the things it says are almost silly because they aren't exactly right. Sometimes they're even wrong. So we need a model that really expands and goes into all areas of healthcare, including the one that I just told you about, the workshop I'm going to do. And the reason I want to do a workshop on this is because there is this attitude about healthcare, which is wrong, that, well, when I get sick, I want to have the government pay for it so I can go get medicine. But are you going to get well? And the bigger issue is, what made you sick in the first place? Wasn't it you? I mean, do you really believe you just walk around and suddenly get sick? Most people don't. And a few people that do actually have some karmic issues from even possibly in a prior life. But the issue is here that staying well is doing a lot more and on an active daily basis. And that's where healthcare needs to be really expanded. That is what needs the support of all of us. And if we're going to have any kind of healthcare coverage, that's the coverage we need. Helping people once they are sick doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense because it has this negative feedback. Helping them to stay well is a much better investment and much more spiritual, and helps them to help others to do the same, because for every person you help to stay well, two other people are likely going to learn something from them ad infinitum. So whether or not people want to have insurance health care situations, most of the time is based, unfortunately, upon their irresponsibility in living. Not always. There are accidents, quote unquote, that happen to people. There are other kinds of things that people deal with in healthcare that sometimes it's convenient to buy insurance for, or it's maybe even cost effective. But that doesn't change the reality that the responsibility of healthcare should fall first on the person trying to do everything they can to stay well. So now I'm going to suggest something that's out-and-out radical, okay? Hold on to your seat, because what I'm going to suggest is so far out there that I don't think anybody's ever suggested it before that I know of. All right? Here it goes. Okay. The more a person documents and proves that they are doing all the things, and I'm talking about way beyond anything that presently is talked about, to stay healthy, the more they actually can do that, the lower the cost of their health care, whether it's supported by the government or otherwise, and the more they help others to teach others to do this, the more it lowers their health care as well. So if they're head of household or family, then if they're helping the whole family to do this, the whole household shares in the benefits. If they are a member of a church or a community organization of some sort, and they participate in that way in that organization or church or whatever, hey, same thing. I know, that sounds like really far out there. Yep. And I suggest that some people who are really creative in the healthcare industry start a company or companies that offer health insurance under the basis that I just suggested. Wow. Now you could say, well, how is that different than having a sliding healthcare policy cost? You're just saying it's lower if you do these things. Well, because the best laid plans of people sometimes don't always work out. Whether you believe in karma or not, you could be walking down the street and somebody can run you over. And then they could be a hit and run and be gone, and then you have to pay for the health care yourself. And a lot of people would say, well, why should you pay more for health care just because you got ran over? And I would agree with that. So you see, there's a shared concept again about health care that we still have to be concerned about. That's why I like the idea that the more you do, whether or not you're successful at it. So we don't have to get into this issue of karma and who deserves to be sick or not or whatever. It gets crazy, I know. Then you just say, if you really done all these great things, and you really, you know, so you went on a diet and you lost this weight and you did these other things, or you exercised and you, whatever. You know, it would have to be some way of documenting to some extent. Then your health care is much less costly, and that allows you to benefit yourself and benefit others by keeping the health care system less costly. The other thing I suggest is that people be given stipends or whatever in treatment, for them to use in whatever way they choose to use it, as long as it's used for some kind of health treatment. And it doesn't have to be allopathic. And it doesn't have to be non-experimental. It can be experimental. It can be whatever it is. to be of help to them in their belief structure, rather than pay an infinite bill, say, look, this is where your level of insurance is based upon what you've done to help keep yourself healthy. Here's the amount of money for the condition that we pay out for this sort of thing. You go and find your best way to deal with that. When you spend it, we'll pay for it up to this dollar amount. We're not going to just give the money, you can go Vegas or something. No. You gotta use it for some kind of system of health care. But it doesn't have to be any prescribed thing that we say is good or bad. If it's experimental, if it's kind of far out there, Chinese medicine, whatever, go ahead, do it. And you just have the widest approach possible. And you might say, well, that sounds pretty goofy. No, it doesn't. Because it says that the person has the right to determine what's best for their health. And the more that they have paid attention to and helped their health, the more they have that right, because the more we give them a larger stipend to go do what they want with it. You see what I'm saying? I hope you're following. Because remember, the spiritual principle of economy is what? That we be free to choose. The present healthcare system does not provide that. You go to a doctor who's in a healthcare system and you have an insurance policy, they write you a letter and they say, sorry, we're not going to pay for this because it's experimental or because it's not on our list of approved methods, or we don't like this particular doctor, or we don't like this particular kind of modality, whatever. That's all wrong. That's not spiritual. So that's why I'm suggesting things that are outside of what you may have ever heard before, because those things don't work. They have serious contradictions in them, and they produce bad results, which we are experiencing. People are going broke trying to pay for health care. Healthcare companies are going broke trying to provide it. Government's involved, which is only going to make things much worse. And nobody's solving the real problems. Okay? I hope that makes sense, but maybe it doesn't. And then you might say, well, okay, but what about this or what about that? Yes, there's going to be all kinds of technical issues and something as complex as healthcare that you have to address. But if you keep these principles in mind that we started the show with, you'll see they can be addressed by applying the principles and working from the principles back or forward, depending upon how you want to look at it, to either correct or create a new problem, and create a new system or correct an old problem. Either way you look at it, it's the way to solve things, and it will achieve those kinds of results. So you can see, again, we're talking about healthcare. Again, it's a national thing, yet at the same time keeping it individual in terms of the way a person has choice. Really, really, really important. Wow. Now what other principles come into play when we're talking about economy? Well, one of them is that I think the sheet of paper that I was going to be bringing in here is now on my desk. Thank you very much. It has come in. The old one disappeared from last week. All right. But I'll get to this in a minute. We'll talk about the end of the show. What are the other things in our economy that we really need to be facing and dealing with so that we can have a more spiritually principled system? Well, one of the things has to do with capital. Now, this gets a little technical, so I'm going to try to keep it as simple as possible. Banking and capital. Right now, if you wanted to start a business, you could try going to a thing called the SBA, Small Business Administration. But the chances of actually getting significant amounts of money to start a business are extremely low. Outside of opening a lemonade stand or doing some very, very small kind of business entity, less than $100,000 for sure, and possibly less than $50,000, you can't, because it's too expensive and the SBA doesn't provide enough resources, and it's somewhat difficult to get that money, particularly in today's economy. So So where do you go if you want to start a business? Well, some people say, well, just don't, why don't you go down in the bank? Yeah, well, that's a good place to try. But the problem is the banks do not lend money as venture capital in most circumstances. You may not know that unless you have tried this before. So we don't have a real venture capitalistic system. We have a venture capitalist, but they are looking to make killings on big businesses that have usually, unfortunately, already established some value to them. You can then question, well, how much venture is there really in the capitalism? Not a lot, but some. So what we need is a different form of venture capitalism. And my suggestion is the following. And this is, I would like this to, not to be done by any governments. I think this needs to be done by private industry, private businesses. And this really takes courage. I'm suggesting that different businesses get together and provide venture capital to people with great ideas. And these businesses are like the ones I talked about at the beginning of the show that have excessive amounts of profit and they're not creating enough themselves. These should be the people that are the true venture capitalists. They should be taking the money instead of just putting it in a bank or whatever, or in their coffers or their treasury or their company, putting it out there for others and using that money to encourage other businesses. Now, the reason they have to have courage is because they may be encouraging other businesses to compete against them. That's possible. That's okay. Because this is a world in which we have to look at the bottom line as far as God is concerned, and not as far as money is concerned. This is the true, true philanthropy of the future. This is such a big concept that it's hard for us to grasp our minds around it because I don't know any place it's being done. But I'm suggesting that it be started here in this country. And some of the greatest minds in business could be involved in this, and especially the people that are making large amounts of profit. Instead of if they've reached a point in their own company where they say, I can't create anymore because I don't have enough time or energy myself. I may have the money, I just don't have the time and energy in my own abilities. So, fine. Get together with some other people just like yourself. Start a huge venture capital fund for new businesses. Businesses that are just completely maybe far out there. Give them an opportunity, but at the same time, don't just give them the money. Give them some of your expertise. Also find others that will join in that maybe don't have the money but have the expertise. Put them into it. And let everyone who has expertise offer it, no matter what your field, no matter what your age. And don't just join some stupid, quote-unquote, organization that supposedly helps people by giving seminars. The senior whatever is doing that around here, and it doesn't help. You want to be able to roll up your sleeves and go into someone's business and actually help them. Seminars don't help people. Come on. You can't help someone in their business through a seminar. You've got to get in there, see how on a day-to-day basis what they're doing wrong and things they're doing right, and help build that business up. That's what we need the people who have retired from business doing. And that's what we need in terms of this kind of venture capitalistic system. It's an amazingly good system. I don't want to connect it to government because it could turn into a form of socialism. And it isn't that. It's not that at all. Rather, it becomes an amazingly spiritually reinforced soul level of giving. And I love this. I mean, this to me is like, this is such a good idea. You got to ask yourself, like, well, how come it isn't happening? Well, it is in a few other countries, actually, but not here. I don't know. They got microbanking with microbanking experts that help people in countries you can't even pronounce. But we don't have any of that going on here. And this is nuts. We could be doing so many amazing things. We've lost our ingenuity because we've lost the ability for people financially to create. The other thing we need to do is reduce government regulation. That's why I don't want government involvement, because those regulate the hell out of it anyway. Get them out of it. Have private industry do this and eliminate 95% of all the regulations around it. And if we're taking care of our atmosphere and other things, which is what I said at the beginning or the middle of the show, we don't have to worry so much about all these environmental restrictions and amazingly difficult things that people do. Yeah, I want a safe, clean work environment no matter what. That makes sense to me. But sometimes the things that are required are way over the top, and they keep people from going into a new business. It's just so expensive. You can't afford it. The permits and the this and that have become impossible. And that's where 90% sometimes of the money of a new business is. It's in all these crazy startup costs that are just over the top. They're mostly government-issued things in some areas of the country. Okay. So here's another way of looking at this. We're dealing with a prosperity level in some parts of our country in terms of our economy. It's quite high. Most of you don't know this, but the banks are making money tremendously right now. Everybody thought the banks are so bad off. They were a couple years ago. That's over with. Good times are here. They're making huge amounts of money, but they aren't lending it as venture capital. They're not lending it for mortgages, new mortgages. Again, the government's overregulating those mortgages also. But they aren't doing much of anything that's really creative with money. It's true. And you can say, well, that doesn't seem right. Well, I'm suggesting a new type of bank, a bank that isn't a bank at all, a venture capital system, if you want to call it that, that won't be under the guidelines of banks, which the government controls, that allows people to become true entrepreneurs and allows many, many small businesses to start up and grow. If we do all the things that I've suggested so far in this show, within 1 year, we would have virtually no unemployment. Virtually none. The only people who be unemployed are the people who don't want to work. That's literally true. Maybe 3.5% or something people will be unemployed or something. And the other thing that's going to happen is you're going to have freedom become the hallmark of our system. And it's that freedom which the world has come to respect and now is losing respect because we don't have the kind of freedom we should have. Again, it's not because the founders didn't want us to be free. It's because we've given in to government control over virtually everything. So I'm suggesting a system here that allows the ability for change without government intervention and allows us to have people finally able to get out from under. Now, you can say, well, just anybody will walk in and say they want $1 million to open their new gadget factory. Well, they might, but they have to have a plan, and they have to present it and argue it in favor of their ability to generate a successful business. Not just to show a profit in a short order, but to show ingenuity, workingness, responsibility. And they make the process of getting the loan, in part, proof of the person's ability to handle the business. There's a lot of things you could do in that respect. I could give you examples of it, but the concept is that if you make the process the actual test, then you'll have much fewer failures, you see. You don't just make it, well, fill these papers out and hand them in. I'll talk to you for 5 minutes later. Now, this has to be a real process. Maybe you have them even do some show and tell stuff. Maybe you have to watch them work on a certain basis. Maybe they have to show they've been successful in some endeavors in their life, showing the ability to stay with it, because you've got to really have that if you're going to be in business. And what about the people who aren't yet ready for business, aren't ready to enter the economy other than working for others? There are a lot of people like that. What do we do for those folks? Because in reality, their issue is, I'm not creative enough to be in business for myself or to do something other than work for someone who is. Well, that's their choice also, so we have to respect it. But how do we improve things for those folks? Do we encourage them to join unions? Well, unions have some interesting benefits for these folks, but the real benefit to them would be the following. If someone is given the opportunity to work for the most, for the best businesses, then they don't have to work for the worst ones, as I described at the beginning of the show. So you need this system, as it gets going after a year or two that I'm describing, of improving economy, needs to address ways to allow people who want to work for other people, they don't want to necessarily be in any kind of business for themselves, either in service or whatever ways of doing it. Give these people the opportunity to do so in the most enlightened working places first by rewarding those people who are running those kinds of businesses with advantages. The advantages are by hiring those people who want to work for them, and they are doing the best kind of business. And you rank businesses by the businesses that are doing the most for all other businesses. So the people who are giving the most and helping the most are also going to get the best employees, because the employees are going to get specific benefits for working for those businesses, which might mean some kind of lowering of taxes or some kind of other benefit. That encourages them to come to these best businesses. It encourages the businesses that don't have the best practices to not be able to find employees or not to have the best employees. It's a really interesting point. I'm not saying this is to sabotage or supplant unions. It gives the unions some competition now. And if the unions are going to be able to help people who want to be in unions, then fine, so be it. But they're going to have to compete against a modification in the capitalistic model that most people think it should be just laissez-faire. I'm suggesting some improvements to this model, at least in part. And so that can move hand in hand with some of the other things that I've described in tonight's show. Again, what we're trying to look at is, how do you make a spiritually principled economy? This isn't about just how to make people wealthier. It's about trying to improve the consciousness of people and make those practices better. What about the professional employed person? They may be working for other people, or they may be working for themselves. What's wrong with the system as professionals are dealt with? Well, one of the things that has concerned me for a long time is that most professionals cannot be depended upon to be truly objective and to be always accurate in what they do. Sometimes they're professional but dead wrong. Well, this has its negative connotations, to say the least, in terms of the economy. Tremendous waste of time, money, material, resources of all sorts goes on because we have that go on. People suffer also. If professionals are dealing with health care or some other issues, it could be terrible suffering. How do we reward professionals, including teachers, by the way, who are doing a good job in comparison to those who are not, in a system that is spiritually founded? Well, one of the things that I think would be helpful is that when a professional is not working for themselves, like teachers working for a school system, or doctors working for a hospital, or whatever it might be, that the principle is that they are evaluated by the services they provide to others and how much those others find their services helpful and at the same time find those services in ways helping them to become better givers themselves. So now they're not only responsible for providing professional services, but in ways that help people to also become a bit more conscious and more giving themselves. That's a real difficult proposition. That's not as difficult for a teacher as maybe it would be for a doctor. But nonetheless, I'm suggesting that the evaluation comes from every person they see. When we give a license to somebody to be a professional, then everybody they see fills out a questionnaire or gives some kind of evaluation, and that evaluation goes into how much that license costs them, because we may charge them more for the license if they're getting some negative comments too often at the time, and then they have to go and get some kind of training to prove that they've improved that before it changes, and we'll give them an opportunity to do that. But if we're talking about professionals who have any kind of licensing, which these days is almost everybody, then it needs to be addressed based upon how the services are being provided to those that they're giving it to, and not by, unfortunately, their contemporaries or their bosses. That doesn't do much good, does it? We've seen how that works in public schools really terribly. Okay. And you might say, well, what if a teacher just is kind of friendly to all the students and they all like that teacher, but they don't learn anything? Well, the students won't be the only person doing this. If they're younger than, say, 18, it'll be their parents as well. And so the parents will be involved. And they'll know whether their kids are learning something or not. And see, so then this becomes part of the system. I like something that allows people to be, if we're going to license, and I think too many people are licensed, by the way, but if we're going to license people, then the license should mean something in terms of the services they provide, and not just whether or not they're competent, but how they provided them and whether it helped people to become more than just provided with service, but they did it in ways that made those people even better people. I know that's the hard part. That's the part that we would have to think a lot, very, very, with great amounts of thought to come up with a system that would really work. Well, let me just go back for a second. I don't want to end the show with this, so I'll go right now with this concept. I'm going to be on April 23rd at 1:30 p.m. I had that part right, which is a Saturday. I think it's 2 weeks from tomorrow, if we count the days, over at Healthy Habit Health Foods, HHH, Healthy Habit Health Foods, 6029 North 7th Street in Phoenix. If you want to come, I think you can just drop in, but I'm not sure about this. You can see how much I don't know what's going on. 602-252-6000. 602-252-6000. I think you can just drop by. But again, if we run out of seats, that's another story. But you can call them if you want to know more. 602-252-6000. They have all kinds of flyers and other things. They have a picture of me in it, too. Natural Health is the name of the workshop. And I hope to see a bunch of you there. Anyone in the Phoenix area who's listening, come on by. And I'd like to meet more of the people who listen to the show. I know there's a number of you out there. Some of you live in the Phoenix area. If you do, come on by. Now, again, this is in Phoenix, 6029 North 7th Street. And that's in Phoenix. Okay. So now let me go on from that little point to have covered. And let's talk about some other principles of economy in terms of how the big picture fits in. How do we deal with the military? Now, a lot of people say, well, the military is like 20-some-odd percent of our economy. It's a huge thing. And how can we change that? Well, the answer is this. Most of the things that we use and expend for in our military have to do with the housing and the care of people. I know a lot of people think it's in weapons development and all that stuff. It really isn't. It's about having millions of people that we have to more or less take care of and pay for. And so here's some suggestions that I have of how a more spiritually principled economy would probably be benefited with a military that is fitting in on a spiritual side. First of all, I think that all military conflicts should be measured even not just a security issue. It is a security issue if we're under threat, but most of the time that's not the case. Not these days, anyway. Could be sometime in the future. Most of the time, we're involved in conflicts because of oil and other assets, so that's why I'm trying to shift that around. So that's going to put less pressure on our military. If you get rid of the oil issue and the gas and a few other natural resources and handle those the way I suggested at the beginning of this, well, the middle, a little bit past the beginning of the show, towards the middle of the show, you're going to save about a third of your costs in the military, right off the bat. You don't need that many people in the military. And if you then did the other things I said in this show, the people who aren't in the military can find jobs in the private sector because there'll be huge numbers of them because of all the growth in the private sector. And so they're not going to be unemployed. So, now, what about the two-thirds we still need, in my opinion? Something in that ballpark. Okay. One of the things I think that would be cost-effective would be to do the following. Let's fund more and more ways to use less and less humans to do what we call military action. Now, I'm not suggesting something like from the Terminator, like Skynet, you know, have computers take over the whole system. I'm suggesting things such as we already have done with drones. But we have the ability to go much further in our technology than drones. We could actually build, somewhat costly at the beginning, robots that literally could be doing the same thing human beings are doing. And while this sounds pretty weird, I am not against the idea that if you're going to have a militaristic society, which we are, and which this world is at the present time, that it would be better to put in harm's way robots or some type of mechanical substitute for a human being than human beings. And you say, yeah, but isn't that technology pie in the sky and all this sort of stuff? No, it's not. It's just how you allocate funding. You see, if you take 20-25% of our economy, and the economy is going to grow tremendously if you did all the things that I suggested, and you said, I want fewer and fewer people that are going to die, now you're going to see how this affects others as well. It's not just our people, and you'll see what I'm going to talk about. I want fewer and fewer people are going to die, and I want fewer and fewer people to be maimed and seriously injured. Then why not take the assets that we have and we convert them as we move people out of the military, we save that money and we build, first of all, you use it for technological research to build some of the most advanced robots ever. And we do this over like a 5-year, 10-year plan, gradually replacing the people in the military. Now, that doesn't mean you don't have any human beings in the military. I'm just saying the ones that are in the highest risk and that don't want to be in that highest risk. I mean, you're always going to have some, you know, special ops people who just love going out there risking their lives. Okay, that's okay. You're going to need people that can do that because robots are never going to be as ingenious or as able to make the snap decisions and be instantaneously creative at the moment. And you can't expect that from a robot, at least not the ones that I'm thinking about. But you can't expect that those few people who do that, fine, they're okay to do that. But you can't expect that the majority of people, military actions can be replaced. And that's a huge savings. Now, why is that so good for others? Because if we're in a military conflict, the bad guys are still going to get hurt, right? They're still going to get hurt by these robots, possibly. Well, I'm just going to suggest something here, that if you've got a bunch of humans up against a bunch of robots, the humans are going to be much more leery and much more concerned, because stopping the robots is going to be a lot harder, and nobody's really going to be hurt from it outside the robot. And so that gives us a tremendous military advantage, and it means more people will give up earlier in any conflict. You could say, well, they may just change your tactics. Why don't they just, they won't fight man-to-man or whatever. No, I don't think so. I think that things have already gone way beyond that possibility. And the robots would reduce the amount of people even killed on the other side, strangely, because many more of them would just give up. And you say, well, wouldn't they get robots? Well, you know what? That's the advantage we have today. It's so expensive to develop the technology and so expensive to build them that I talk about the United States. Remember, this is an example economy situation. We would be able to support this, and most other countries could not, and especially the countries that are doing the most evil in the world could not support it. And those are the countries that we're having a lot of issues with. If you follow what I'm saying, this makes every bit of sense. And it saves lives. It reduces a tremendous amount of harm to people and maiming of people on both sides. And it allows us to develop a whole new industry, in effect. Some of these robots aren't the ones that are off doing military jobs, but some of them might eventually be doing some menial tasks in society. Now, do I think it's good that we have robots that are running around replacing human beings for everything? No. And I don't think they can, by the way. That's another issue for another day. It's about consciousness and how robots, by not having consciousness, can't function as a human being. They can only function as what they are, which is an intelligent machine. Intelligence and consciousness are two different things. Now, if we can get robots to become conscious, we've created a new life form, and that's a whole different thing. And when human beings get to that level, we have to talk about a lot of other issues, not just the question of whether we should have robots. Okay, so in addressing the issue with the military and economy, we now see a reversal of the real negative parts of military action, which is that it hurts a lot of people, so we'll hurt less, and especially less people that belong to the country that we are in, and try to hurt as few people as possible on the other side. Because if you have overwhelming force, you actually create less injuries. When you don't go in strong, I wish the President of the United States, of our United States today, understood this. If you don't go in strong, you don't go in hard, more people die. More people are hurt. Innocent people and military people. It's a bad way to do anything. That sometimes this is a difficult lesson to learn. Okay, so that part of the economy could become spiritualized, oddly. Now, I know that sounds strange. It's a very strange, strange concept. But, again, these things I'm suggesting tonight are kind of out there. I'm not suggesting things that are just, 5 minutes ahead of us. These are things that a lot of people have either not suggested, or if they have, they haven't really thought it through, I think, in a well enough way to make a good stab at it, so to speak. Okay. What other principle in economy would be good to use that's spiritual to make things a better place? Well, the overall issue here is, I'm going to just address it, I've only got a few minutes left here, is government itself. Our economy right now is too connected to the government in a whole bunch of ways. And the government doesn't produce anything. It doesn't create anything. It's a consumer. And it is in competition with private industry and private business. unless it takes those businesses over. It's a socialist government. So the idea that bigger government is better government is absurd. It doesn't make any sense. It didn't make any sense to the founders of our country. It wasn't built into the nature of our laws and the Constitution. But now somehow today it's being touted as a real good thing, particularly by people calling themselves progressives. It doesn't make any sense. And I'll explain it this way. If you want to have a spiritual economy, you need to have a very limited government involved with that spiritual economy, or it will consistently corrupt the economy and eventually destroy it. Because as the government grows, the spiritual side of economy shrinks, whether the full economy in total does or not. So government hurts, expanding government, making it larger, hurts the spiritual side of economy, which is what we're talking about tonight, more than it hurts the economy in general. And that's what's so bad about it. That's why it's very dark and evil and why the founders didn't want that. They wanted a very limited government. That's one of the reasons. And they wanted the right to property and the freedom to have property and control it, which means control business. And I'll give you an example of how dark this process could become. The Federal Trade Commission has more power than anybody, any part of the government, because of interstate commerce. There's a clause in the Constitution saying that the United States government has the right to mitigate and in some circumstances control interstate commerce for the benefit of people across state lines. Okay. What they meant by that is that someone can't be doing something terrible to someone else in another state and get away with it because they're in a different state. Okay? And the government can do something about that. But instead, this whole thing has been reversed. So now the government has become the controller over all kinds of businesses and industry, regulating and controlling, not for the purpose of protecting people, but for the purpose of controlling people and businesses. And this is a bastardization of the original concept. It's really taking it and just changing it to something entirely wrong and different. It was never meant to be. It was never made to be. And it's really, it's like taking, since they really had a good intention and turning into a real evil intention. And this is one of the most greatest proponents of the expansion of our government meddling in our economy. And it's terrible. We need to change that. I believe that it might take an amendment to the Constitution stating that government has only limited control over interstate commerce and it has to be defined by a few sentences. That's one of the things that we need to do. Also, just generally, shrinking government would go a long way to making the system a lot more enlightened, allowing the government and for the economy to become more effective. Limited government is more effective. Growing economy is more effective. When you reverse the two, you end up with evil over the long run, and certainly darkness to begin with. We're on that road right now, so we need to make some changes about it, and we need to make it very quickly. The amount government grows is based upon the amount of money it expends, whether or not it collects it in taxes or not. If it prints the money, it still grows itself, but it also destroys the economy. So be cautious when people talk about, well, we should have more government spending for this or that. The more it spends, I don't care what it's for. I don't care what it's for. The more it spends, the bigger the government is, the more intrusive it is, the more dangerous it is to the liberties of all people, and the more we're likely to be taken over by a dictator. Or worse, some even more serious kind of new inventive group of dictators. It's a dangerous, dangerous thing. Okay, we're out of time for right now. I want you to seriously contemplate and consider everything I said. Thanks so much for listening tonight. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.